This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
All these different practices are eminently scalable. That's one of the reasons why I picked them. They aren't there yet because of a number of other issues that stand in the way, principally how we think.
Author Courtney White believes he has a quick fix for what ails the planet. Build topsoil, fix creeks, and eat meat from pasture-raised animals. He outlines this strategy in his latest book, Grass, Soil, Hope, A Journey Through Carbon Country. We discuss the profound impact that could result from some simple changes in ranching and farming practices, and why this might appeal to both liberals and conservatives. Then we hear from British-based sustainability consultant Michael Townsend, who explains why we need to reframe how we view the economy to better incorporate well-being. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by author Courtney White. His latest book is 2% Solutions for the Planet. Courtney, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks, Alex. Good to be back.
So we had you on for your last book, actually. It was fascinating. It was called Grass, Soil, Hope. And while you were researching that book, you stumbled across some pretty interesting solutions and stories that you weren't able to include in that book. Now explain how 2% Solutions differs from Grass, Soil, Hope, and what kind of solutions you're talking about here.
Yeah, you bet. So Grass, Soil, Hope, which came out about a year and a half ago, focused mostly on carbon sequestration in soils. I know that's a mouthful, but it focuses on how plants and trees and grass can pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis and store it in soils. And this was news to me at the time when I first heard about it. We've been involved in conservation, ranching, farming activities out here in New Mexico for a while, and I'd been involved in ecological restoration, local food, things like that, but I hadn't really thought about the climate consequences until I came across a publication that said you can sequester carbon in soils. And I thought, wow, that's great. So I dug into that research, looked at farming practices, ranching practices, some other things that did that. They were able to kind of draw down carbon dioxide and store it in soils through best management practices. And, that led to Grass, Soil, Hope. But in the process, I found all these extra stories that just weren't going to make it into the book. So the 2% refers to a couple things. 2% soil carbon increase, and that's maybe a mouthful again, but what I'm saying is that if you think about anybody who's listening as a gardener, you know that the soil in your garden, that dark, rich soil, a lot of that's carbon. And that's what makes it fertile and productive. Carbon is sort of the essential building block of life. Everything that living on the planet has carbon in it, including soils, as healthy soils, biologically active soils. And if you increase the soil carbon by just 2%, which is, not very much, you can have all of these positive beneficial consequences. It stores more water, it's more fertile for the plants, as I said. Carbon's kind of plant food, in a sense. So who does this work? Well, only 2% of the population in America, and that's the population of farmers and ranchers, which is, we're down to 2%. That's all we got left. And then finally, 2% of the GDP, and I just pulled that number a little bit out of the air, so to speak, because I'm not sure how much it would be, but the idea that for a very little amount of money, and we have a lot of money in this country, we're a wealthy nation, but for a very little amount of it, done by just a few people, increasing just carbon in soils just a little bit, we can have all of these positive consequences and benefits from food to water to climate, all for just 2%.
Why don't you explain some of the solutions that you set forth in the book, if you can, specifically?
Yeah, and I should say up front that part of the difference between this book and Grass, Soil, Hope is also the sort of the formatting of it. These are shorter profiles. There's 50 of them. They have photographs in color. What I was trying to do is try to sort of provoke and educate with kind of short profiles, hopefully stimulating a reader to dig deeper. So these are 50, nature-based, low-tech, low-cost practices, technologies, and other kinds of activities that do all these wonderful things. So the book's divided into five parts. One part is ranching, one part is farming, one part involves technology, and by that I mean appropriate technology, one part is restoration, and one part is wildlife, because I find that we keep sort of leaving nature out of the equation here when we talk about the planet and climate and food and things like that. So I wanted to make sure that we got to look at nature through this lens as well. So some of the practices, I've been writing about ranching for many years, about holistic management, rotational grazing, things that stimulate grass growth, that sequester more carbon in soils, those kinds of things. So there's 10 stories in that chapter that cover different aspects of livestock, not just cattle, but sheep. For example, a flerd. And a flerd is a flock of sheep and a herd of cattle, commingled. And I ran across this in Australia on a farm where the rancher said, hey, let's put these herbivores together and move them around the ranch and draw benefits from the way they graze differently and their different kinds of manure and fertilizer. And he had tremendous ecological response. He raised the diversity of grasses on his farm, which was kind of worn out when he bought it, from 6 species to over 100 species just by managing the grazing of his flerd in a very progressive manner. And that was definitely out of the box, because most livestock operators do not mingle cattle and sheep together. And he said, I don't care about that. Nature does it. Nature mingles things together, and let's put these animals together. And that sort of fundamentally is what the book keeps coming back to. Nature has the best ideas. We tend to get away from nature. We tend to think we have the best ideas, when in fact we keep coming back to nature. So the way nature moves animals around landscapes, there's a story about Sam Montoya, who's a grass farmer near Albuquerque. He divided up 93 acres of irrigated ground near his home and put 33 paddocks, or electric fences, down, created 33 paddocks, and moved his cows around it every single day. And he grew all this grass. He was mimicking wild herbivores, the way they move across landscapes, but he was doing it with electric fencing instead. And he turned a depleted sod farm that just had gone belly up, he turned it back into a vibrant grass bit of nature. Geese flew in, cattle got fat, again by mimicking natural behavior. In this case, grazers. He uses cattle instead of bison, but the principles are the same.
And this is just one farmer. How scalable is a solution like his, and how replicable, and what would it actually mean if more and more people embraced it?
Yeah, that's a good question. What I tried to do in the book was create a sort of an alternate narrative to the gloomy headlines that we hear about climate and things today. We have this kind of ideology that big problems require big solutions, geoengineering, big treaties, and that kind of the point of the book was that we have all of these practices and technologies that have been tested, beta tested for 30 years. They exist now. They exist today. We can put them to work. So Sam Montoya's story is a good one. How many folks do what Sam does? Not very many. But what Sam did was entirely scalable. I mean, it was just a piece of land that he managed differently. And it's irrigated ground along the Rio Grande, north of Albuquerque. So any land that's similar to what he had could be managed this way very, very easily. The issue, though, I found, is not the practices themselves. It's the paradigms involved. We tend to not do things not because we don't have enough money or we don't have enough opportunity or education, even. Is that we tend to just have our minds in the way. So in this case, Sam managed his land very differently than how other land along the river is managed, which can be for alfalfa production, a lot of it, or they just sort of spread the cows out. So to answer your question, all these different practices are eminently scalable. That's one of the reasons why I picked them. They aren't there yet because of a number of other issues that stand in the way, principally how we think.
Older and wiser now, and I'm never gonna fall for that old, never gonna fall for that old fairy tale anymore, 'cause I've been schooled before. And 'cause I'm foo-foo.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Courtney White. His latest book is 2% Solutions for the Planet. As an author who goes around the country talking about these issues, what kind of feedback are you getting? What kind of both positive and negative feelings do you get when you try to set forth these seemingly simple solutions?
Yeah, I mean, kind of two broad responses. One, a lot of excitement. I mean, folks want to hear hopeful stories. I mean, they want to hear that this problem isn't too big, meaning the climate problem isn't too big already, too big to solve, too big to handle, that there's something that folks can do on the ground, and then they get hopeful also about the sort of the links between these practices and the food they eat, the water they drink. These are practices that have multiple benefits. It's not just about climate and carbon types of issues, but when you manage land in this way, you can produce food organically, you can produce grass-fed meat if you're a meat eater, you can have all kinds of philosophical, emotional, educational, recreational benefits flow from well-managed landscapes. And so folks, you know, not just want to hear these stories, but they respond to them, and they understand them intuitively. I think folks understand that that these landscapes, when managed well and managed in sort of nature's image, have all these sort of cascading benefits for us. In terms of the sort of negative responses, I haven't had a lot. I think a lot of folks understand that these are out-of-the-box kinds of challenges. I mean, generally you get criticisms about, say, organic farming can't feed the world. There's been research that says that yes, it can. In fact, it can be as productive, maybe even more productive in some circumstances, than industrial food production. It's just often not given a chance. And then you kind of get into the tussles and back and forthing between academics and researchers, sometimes with their own agendas about things, which gets a little discouraging when scientists kind of argue with each other. Many of the farmers and ranchers that I know don't have those arguments. They just go do the work, and they see the results. So you get into some of those larger philosophical issues, not so much the practical issues about the methods themselves, but, you know, like, should we be eating meat? You know, there's been kind of an anti-red meat thing recently. It kind of popped back up. Worried about the climate effects of industrial food meat production, with good concern. It's a system that produces a lot of methane, which is a bad greenhouse gas. Not that there are any good greenhouse gases, I guess. But when you look down at the practices themselves, I think they're kind of win-win-win all the way down the line. You pull back and you get into larger issues. Is it scalable? Can you feed all these people? You know, should we be eating meat? They're more philosophical kinds of questions. You run into more resistance.
Do you think ranchers and farmers are generally conservative or liberal?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. I started a nonprofit organization here in Santa Fe called the Quivira Coalition, and one of my board members, a rancher, was politically one of the most conservative people I've ever met, just very, very conservative, and yet he was the best land manager I ever met. So he was extremely progressive in how he managed his ranch, way decades ahead of other folks. I mean, he saw the benefits of these practices back in the 60s. And so you talk to them about land and water and animals. You have a very progressive conversation. If you talk about national politics, you don't. I love him. He's a great guy. We have great conversations. I'm politically pretty liberal. We don't let any of that get in the way of the land, however. And that's what's wonderful about working on these issues. The politics kind of drains away when you talk about land and water and animals. It transcends ideologies and political boundaries, which gives me a lot of hope, because I see so much political gridlock and so much fighting these days among groups that it gets discouraging.
But it's pretty encouraging, I guess, to realize that these solutions really do cross political ideology.
Yeah, there's kind of an old, metaphor, I guess, you know, that if you're going to build a house, it doesn't matter what political party that you belong to, everybody gets together and they build a house. I mean, you use the same tools, you work together to raise a barn or build a house. And that's kind of what land management is like. If you're just talking about the sort of the nuts and bolts, the structure of the land, the health, the plants, the water, you know, almost everybody can come together and talk about this. It's curious, here in New Mexico, the last couple of years, there's been a bill in the state legislature to do some watershed restoration across the state, and it always has bipartisan support. In a state that, you know, we're, like many Western states, we're politically divided, urban and rural, and, you know, Democrat and Republican, and there's a lot of kind of fighting over this issue, that issue. But when it comes to watersheds, land health, food, all of that melts away, and it's such an interesting dynamic to kind of watch. It can be for different reasons: agriculture, jobs, you know, taxes, wildlife is important to folks, that kind of stuff. But it's neat to see. Sometimes these things don't quite do enough or go far enough to kind of to make larger changes in landscapes. But the base effort there exists, meaning that folks want to try to work together on these problems.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Courtney White. His latest book is 2% Solutions for the Planet. So, Courtney, on a policy level, do you think states or the federal government can put in some policies that would accelerate the kind of solutions you set forth in your book?
It's a number of things. A lot of folks we work with are private landowners, where they can they don't have to tangle with some of the bureaucracies put down by agencies. And by that I mean a private landowner can implement a grazing scheme or pattern that he or she wants to do. They can do ecological restoration as long as they get the right permits and things like that. When you get into public land out west, it gets more complicated, of course. You've got agencies, you've got regulations, you've got interest groups vying for influence over these landscapes. So it becomes more complicated. At the federal level, to implement some of these things would require policy changes, maybe the Farm Bill in particular. And that, of course, you get ensnared immediately in Congress and all the troubles and issues involved in the federal level. The state's better. We have a state land office here in New Mexico that is independent of the legislature and can do things that it wants. There are regulations, of course, on things. It kind of depends where you are. Where the most action is, I think, is on the county level. The county commissioners have kind of a lot of discretion and a lot of ability to do things. And then also Native American reservations, tribes, which are sovereign, have the ability to do a lot of things on their own. That just kind of by the way that they're structured and their relationship to other political bodies. And so they're, most of these practices can be done on private land. A lot of them can be done on public land if we can get some policy changes. I'm hopeful, but things change slowly.
Courtney White, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Michael Townsend. He's the founder and CEO of Earthshine Solutions, which is a management consultancy that focuses on sustainability efforts. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex. It's a pleasure to join you and your listeners.
So you just edited a book/journal called Reframing the Game, The Transition to a New Sustainable Economy. So why did you put this publication together, Reframing the Game? What was the motivation behind it?
I set out on a journey in search of capitalism 2.0. What would a better system look like? And I was surprised at what I found, both in terms of the solutions that are already available, but also something important for the soul, genuine cause for hope, generated by a very real sense that a new system for economy was already manifesting. Pockets of great ideas and new practices going on around the world. And if you were to join this up into a great new picture, you could see that actually a new way was possible. A quiet revolution, if you like, was already underway if we could allow it to flourish. So it seemed to me quite important that we start bringing people together from the world of business, from the world of education and academia, to try and kind of thrash out what the issues were and what the solutions were and how we could take things forward. So this journal stroke book, Reframing the Game, is the next step, if you like, on this journey in bringing people together to explore key issues, topics around, well, what's the purpose of our economy? Is it just about growth and GDP, and we should all just carry on focusing on that? Or are there a wider range of goals and indicators that would make for a healthier economy and a more balanced and natural life for us? That's one area. So there's a great piece in there by Isabel Sebastian, where she explores the sort of different models that are available and how we can actually move towards a more holistic approach for our economy.
Yeah, she calls it a well-being economy.
That's right. And it's all about changing the focus for the economy and having different indicators, but also changing the narrative, the story and purpose for our economy. Is it that we should just exist to work so that we serve the economy and we keep facilitating growth? Or is it that we should look at this the other way around? Should we design the economy to deliver what it is that we all need across society, communities, including business, including in our communities, such that the economy serves us, not the other way around. So I think Isabel Sebastian does a great job to show us different models and to come up with some practical suggestions for the business world and for policy leaders around how we could reframe the economy around well-being, not just growth.
Right. And Sebastian writes, is corporate social responsibility or CSR enough in a new economy? And that really spoke to me in a lot of ways, in that we cover a lot of CSR efforts here in Sea Change Radio. But it seems like as more and more of the largest corporations are getting on board with the idea of having corporate social responsibility being a piece of their puzzle, we need to go beyond that. It's great that they've embraced CSR principles in a lot of ways, but it also makes me suspicious that so much of it is window dressing when these companies are maybe pushing mom and pop businesses to the side.
Absolutely. It's a big theme through this project and what we're taking forward into the future. What's the business of the future look like? And CSR, yeah, it's probably a necessary step on the journey. It allows companies to kind of engage in the conversation about what they need to do more holistically for the business. But yes, you're absolutely right, Alex, that so much of it is window dressing. It can be great PR, and it can be some genuine improvements too. But usually they're fairly incremental, maybe some minor reductions in energy usage or carbon footprint, waste, and so on. But the real purpose of the business can often still be quite destructive. Some of the mainstream banks, you know, their business models are have wreaked havoc through the world. You know, we need to have a complete overhaul on the way that businesses work and operate. So we do need to move beyond CSR. It's a good stepping stone, but it's like when you go to school, when you're a kid, you learn some stuff in the early grades, but that's not the end of your journey, is it? You know, there's a whole lot more you've got to get down and get sorted. And I think the business world going forward, there's going to be a lot more around the purpose of business and business strategy and how that needs to change in focused on the challenges we face in the world and on solving problems for society.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to management consultant Michael Townsend. So, Mike, can you give us some examples from both the public and the private sectors in what you're talking about in terms of trying to transform the economic value from a one that's built entirely on growth as its barometer for success into one that's as a well-being economy? Why don't you first talk about some government policies that you think are good templates for us to try to replicate elsewhere, and then maybe turn to the business world if you can.
If we go to the piece that Isabel Sebastian wrote, she's been quite influenced by the work that's gone on in Bhutan with the Gross National Happiness Index. So in Bhutan, they're already working and living by this model where they're not just thinking about growth. They're actually measuring indicators of well-being and happiness for the people in Bhutan and making sure their policies are joined up in being able to deliver on these indicators so that they can actually say whether they've got an economy that's working for the people or not. And there's a whole range of other different models that we could draw from. And I think the purpose of this at this stage is to say, look, there are different ways of doing it. It doesn't have to be just about GDP. That's really important to get those goals and the purpose of the economy defined wherever you are in the world. It'll drive everything else. So that's, I think, starts to address things policy-wise. Moving into the sort of business zone, this is really important as well. We need to change the story of business. Probably since Milton Friedman's famous essay around 1970, I think it was published in New York Times, where he basically said the purpose of business is to maximize shareholder returns. You know, that's been the kind of dialogue, you know, about business. When I was at business school as well in the 90s, you know, that was the thing, you know, everything you did was around maximizing shareholder return. Now I think we've seen that model as flawed and we need to move to new models of business success. And it's most interesting to see people like Richard Branson, who's obviously a very well-known and respected entrepreneur, a very successful businessman. So he's set up what is known as the B team to redefine what business is about and what business success looks like. And we see the re-emergence of the cooperative movement since the financial crisis, where people want to take a stake in the company they're working in, and they're prepared to put the hours in as long as they get the rewards as well. And they can also make decisions for the longer term success for their communities that they operate within, and maybe some of the decisions, the difficult decisions that are needed around the environment too.
Mike Townsend, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's an absolute pleasure, and I hope to share more with you in the future.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Tony Rice and Ron Sexsmith.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.